Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, our guest is Bill Timaeus, religion columnist for the Kansas City Star. Welcome, Bill.
How are you?
You can hear me all right by phone?
Sir. Yep.
Good. Well, we have a good connection. Thank you for being on the program.
Glad to do it.
Now, the last time we talked with you here on Keeping the Faith, you were working on a project with a rabbi on Jews and Christians in Poland during World War II. How has that research turned out?
We have just this last week completed the manuscript and sent it to the publisher. The University of Missouri Press wants to publish this. We spent most of last year sort of pinballing around the United States as well as spending time in Poland interviewing people. The thrust of the book is that it's about Jews in Poland who survived the Holocaust with non-Jewish help, which in almost every case means Catholic or at least Christian help. And we have put together 15 to 18 or a few more stories of people who survived in that way, and there weren't very many. But the book is essentially done, and we hope to have it in print sometime next year.
Do you have any idea what the press will title it? I know often authors don't have a say in that.
Yeah, we have. We think we have come up with a title, which is this: "They Were Just People," and then colon stories of rescue in Poland during the Holocaust. The term rescue is one that's used a lot to refer to non-Jews who helped to hide and save Jews. We think it's a little bit of a problematic phrase or term because it seems to imply that the Jews who were saved did nothing, were very passive, and that's very far from the truth. They were they survived by their own wits and courage, and they needed that, and they certainly needed help from non-Jews to get through this, but even that wouldn't have been enough. So it was, we try to point that out, that the term rescuer is a little bit problematic, but that's the term of art, so to speak.
We may get some callers who have questions about that whole project, but our main topic today is going to be about your activity not only as a columnist for the newspaper, the Kansas City Star, but your work as a blogger and your Bill's Faith Matters blog that many people look at, and your experiences with that. When did you actually start your blog?
I began it 3.5 years ago, just before Christmas of 2004. I had been thinking about it before then, and the editors at the Star, Kansas City Star, had encouraged me to think about doing a daily blog or a regular blog. It's turned out to be daily. But we launched it toward the end of December, just before Christmas, as I say, of 04. And we now have been up and running for all of this time. I do a daily entry, except on the weekends when I do an entry that covers both Saturday and Sunday, although sometime during the weekend I may, in fact, add a little something to it. But that has been the experience, and I've really enjoyed doing it. I used to write for a couple of decades or more a daily column the editorial page at the Star, and I've sort of missed. I later changed to write a weekly column and do some other things, and I sort of missed the daily routine. And so this has allowed me to find that rhythm again and to give readers material and information that I simply don't have time or space to give them in a column.
What are the constraints of the writer of a blog? Do you make promises to anybody? Can you write as much or as little as you like? What do you do when you have no ideas? I have several questions.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah. Well, in reality. reality, blogs are a very wide open format, and many people seem to just go on endlessly on their blogs, and I don't know who reads that stuff, frankly. I find that it's helpful to keep blogs to a reasonable length, and by reasonable length, 300 to 500 words is... You get much past that, and readers begin to lose interest. But I find that that's a pretty good length, and the more links I can give readers so that they can click on them and go find other information, the better they seem to like it, and the more useful it is to them. So just in terms of length, that's kind of where I operate. But other bloggers have their own rules, and I really don't report to anybody about this. The Star puts my blog, a link to my blog, on the Star's own website, which is kansascity.com. And once you're at kansascity.com, you'll find a list of blogs, and mine is in that list, and you just click on it, and there you are.
And, of course, it can also be found through Google or Yahoo searches just by putting in Bill Tamaeus. And I might spell your name. It's T-A-M-M-E-U-S, Bill Tamaeus. And if you put that name in plus blog, and you'll get that's another way to it, of course, as well. Now, Bill, do you have any sense of how many people read this?
Yeah, I keep two unreliable counters on the blog. I use the platform, as it's called, a company called TypePad, and they have a counter that I can look at. And I also have put a counter from a different company called SiteMeter on there. And it has ranged from, in the early days, from a few dozen readers a day to 1,700 a day, and it ranges all over the lot in there. Some days it's very active, and I've never quite figured out what it is that on a particular day will drive traffic. Obviously, for bloggers, the more places you can have links to your blog. That is, the more sites out there that have you on them, and there's a Presbyterian blogger site, there's a religion news service site, there's places like that link me in addition to the Star site. But the more of those you can have, the better traffic you have. And traffic seems like an odd term for real human beings who are lovely readers, and I'm happy to have them. And I don't think of them as traffic, and unless I am referring to them in this sense. But so some days it's just a few hundred folks, and some days it's well over that. So, and I really don't worry a lot about numbers. I would love to have 10,000 readers a minute, but the fact is that people will find a blog that is useful to them and very often stay with it for quite a while. I've had some very long time, 3.5 year readers who have been there practically every day, so that's been gratifying.
Now, I noticed on your blog for this weekend that you refer to the fact you're going to be interviewed on this show, and you mentioned that I would be giving phone numbers, so if people who read you would like to call in, they could.
Yeah.
Let me do that now. No matter where this program is heard, people may call toll-free on the telephone 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of this station, this NPR regional station here out of the University of Illinois. We, in addition, of course, have local listeners who can punch in a local number. And in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, you may call us at 333-9455. So local callers, 333-9455. If it's long distance, do use a toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. And since this program is available on the internet. I do need to say that although we have listeners overseas, I know we can only accept calls from the continental U.S., so we do have that limitation. But our guest today is Bill Tameus, T-A-M-M-E-U-S, religion columnist for many years at the Kansas City Star. Bill, how many years have you had a column that dealt with issues of ethics and spirituality and values and so forth?
It's a little bit complicated to answer because I started at the Star in 1970 as a reporter, and I moved to the editorial page in 1977, really as a humor columnist. But as I was writing allegedly funny stuff, I was also, on occasion, writing more serious columns, and those columns tended to look at the world through my own theological lenses, which are untrained lenses in any formal sense. But those columns began to add up and add up, and as I was writing them, I was also complaining to editors that we don't put enough resources into covering religion and ethics. We have, like most newspapers our size, one person who covered all of that. And finally, the editors got tired of me griping about it and asked if I would move my column to our weekly faith section and also help them help by writing news stories and analysis in the religion and ethics area. So in early 2004, I moved my column over to the faith section, and there it is devoted exclusively to matters of religion and so on. And actually, then I took formal retirement in the middle of 2006, but I continue to write a weekly column in the faith section on a freelance basis and do that from home, essentially.
Now, in one of your recent, well, I guess I'm a little confused. I tend to read some of your blogs and some of your columns and sometimes can't remember which was which, but in one of your recent writings, you were talking about why you thought it was important that American young people actually get to study about religion in schools. Tell us a little bit about why you think that's the case.
Well, I was in that column was promoting an idea that is fresh in a relatively new book by a religious scholar named Steve Prothero, who's at Boston University, I believe. Steve's book is called Religious Literacy, and I've long felt that people in this country cannot be considered educated and literate if they are unable to understand basic notions of religion, to understand the biblical references that are simply permeated. I mean, they're everywhere in our language when we say we go the second mile or my brother's keeper and so on. Those are all biblical stories, and if people have no idea what those stories are about, they're essentially cut out of a lot of the cultural conversation. I think it's important, particularly in this time of growing diversity in the religious landscape in America, for people to be educated about not only the dominant religion in this country, Christianity, but also other religions that are becoming more and more prevalent. Certainly since 1965, when Lyndon Johnson signed reform of immigration law into effect, people, particularly from the Southern Hemisphere and Asia, have come here in great numbers and have brought with them Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism and Sikhism and on and on and on, although there were some of those adherents here before, but the numbers have increased dramatically. And we are in a period, especially since 9/11, when we need to understand what other faiths are about, as well as our own, if we have one. So I think it's just essential that as students in high school and junior high and college learn grammar and learn history and learn sociology and all of those other subjects, they also have at least a speaking relationship with the basics of what religion is about. And I'm not certainly advocating that public schools teach religion in the sense of evangelism or try to turn them into Christians or Jews or Muslims or Hindus, but rather that they simply be familiar with all of those religions as well as biblical literature.
Of course, this is a difficult topic because back when there was a very strong Protestant Christian hegemony in this country, Protestant Christians tended to abuse that, and often forced other people to hear Protestant Christians proselytize and evangelize, and under the guise of teaching about religion, it really was oppressive to people who had a different faith or no faith at all.
That's absolutely right, Steve, and that's one of the things that the courts have tried to, when cases have come to the courts have said, no, you can't proselytize, you can't try to make converts in public schools. But as Prosero points out, the Supreme Court in various cases has almost begged schools to teach about religion in a fair, balanced way. Now, that requires a training of teachers. It requires a good curriculum. It requires a curriculum that takes religion seriously, but that also doesn't lean in one direction or another. As you pointed out, historically, Protestants, you know, this country was a landslide for Protestants. And as it turns out, Protestants today, we know from many recent surveys and sources, are barely a majority of all Americans. In fact, it looks to me as though the Protestant majority has just slipped below 50%. Protestants will no doubt be a plurality for a very long time, and Christianity will certainly be the dominant religion in America, at least through most of this century. Now, the number of Christians, the percentage of Christians in our population is slowly slipping, and it continues to do that, and it's possible that by the end of the century, Christians will be simply a plurality and not a majority. And in that case, that's one more reason to teach about religion and not to favor one religion over another in the teaching. And it is complicated, but it can be done, and it really needs to be done because we have a lot of ignorant folks walking around out here whose ignorance is leading to tension and even prejudice and bias, and that leads to fear, which leads to violence, and it's a terrible circle or a terrible spiral that we have to avoid.
Universities and colleges have been quite successful in this country's history in teaching about religion in an objective way, and there are very good texts that introduce young people, students, to the central ideas, the central practices, the beliefs, customs, traditions, and so forth of the various religions, and there are people with PhDs in religion who are trained to do that. At the lower levels, it's been more difficult to find people and school districts, since they're so separate and independent in this country, who are willing to place that high on their agendas.
That's right, and I, in writing this recent column, I took the time to call about half a dozen of the major public school districts in the Kansas City area to see whether any of them was teaching this subject, and none of them is at the moment. One said, "Oh, we used to have a class about that," and I said to one of the curriculum people, is anybody demanding it? Is anybody asking for it? She says, no, not really. And that really saddens me. I mean, I think I think those kids are in trouble long term, and parents ought to be demanding a better education. And as I say, that will take some excellent texts and some training of teachers to do it right, to meet constitutional standards, but it can be done.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon live with Bill Tameus, T-A-M-M-E-U-S, who is a religion columnist for the Kansas City Star newspaper and a blogger on religious issues. You can find him at billtimaeus.typepad.com, or you can go to kansascity.com and follow the links to his blog. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. I might just mention that for the next 4 or 5 weeks, I'm going to be traveling with my spouse, and Don Nolan will be our guest host, and we'll be talking with quite a few interesting folks over the time when I'm traveling. I want to thank Don Nolan, who is a professor of philosophy and religion, who's taught at Parkland College for many years, who will be has been a substitute host here before and will be for the next 4 or 5 weeks. We're talking with Bill Tameus, and if callers would like to join the conversation, do join us, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. And there's a toll-free number if it's a long-distance call for you, 1-800-222-9455. Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455 for a toll-free call. Bill, what have been some of the columns over the years and the blogs that have got the most response, either in critical response, negative or positive?
Well, one of the subjects that tends to get a lot of response is one that I write about with some frequency, and that's death. Americans seem, in my perspective, to be death deniers. They don't want to talk about death. It's a subject that they just as soon avoid. And I am fairly insistent that we need to talk about death, because I believe that if we don't have some understanding of our own death, there's no way to understand our life. So I have written, for instance, a column from my mother's funeral some years ago. It's the first column in my book called A Gift of Meaning. But I've written a lot of columns about various aspects of death, and will continue to do so. And I find that some people say, you know, drop the subject for heaven's sakes. I don't want to hear about it. But many others are grateful that there is a place to think openly and publicly about the subject that often is taboo. And the subject just fascinates me. I've given a little bit of thought to creating a blog about that would in perhaps take me from my current situation, where I'm healthy, 63 years old, got six little grandkids here in town and in Kansas City, and my wife and I between us have six kids, and life is good, but take me from there on toward my inevitable death, and to wrestle with the issues as they come up, of health issues and of am I my work? Am I something beyond that? What do I believe about an afterlife, if anything? And all of those subjects. And I may just break out and do a separate thing about that, because I think it's so important. But that tends to get a lot of reaction. And when I write about controversial subjects like how churches and other communities of faith deal with questions of human sexuality, people have really strong opinions about that, and I hear from them in all kinds of ways. I am an elder in a Presbyterian church, and my denomination until its most recent General Assembly vote forbids the ordination of gays and lesbians to ministry. The church has just voted to change that rule, although that has to be approved by regional governing bodies over the next year. And I'm not sure it will be approved, but I favor otherwise qualified gays and lesbians being ordained to ministry, and it's a position that I base on biblical exegesis and study and so on, and I find that when I write about that, people are just all over my case, saying that I'm going to hell for this and all of that, and a few others who are very glad that someone is speaking up for them. So it's subjects like that that tend to get people's juices stirring, I find.
When you write about death, how do you make it interesting?
Well, for instance, in the column that I wrote about my mother's death, it was a bit of an insight to me as we were driving up to my hometown in northern Illinois, in Woodstock, that at age 50, I and my three sisters had just become orphans. My father had died 4 years earlier. And so I talked about the notion of being an orphan at age 50, which I think was a little bit of a fresh insight into losing someone at that age and what it means for me now to move on. And I think it is so easy to fall into cliches about these subjects, and what I really struggle to do and try to do is to have something fresh to say, and to say it from having just experienced whatever it was, whether it was this person's funeral or some years ago I wrote a column about a pilot that I saw in a plane that crashed quite near where I live, and I was an eyewitness to that plane going below the tree line and disappearing. And when you are there as an eyewitness and can report on this particular funeral or what that person, how that person died, I think it lends credence to any conclusions you draw about it, because it's your own experience.
When you were mentioning the issue of sexuality, particularly in Christian churches and ordination of gays and lesbians as pastors and elders and so forth, I would think as a newspaper columnist and a blogger, you would be sort of much more exposed when you take a progressive opinion on that than many of us. I was very fortunate to be pastor of a church here in Champaign-Urbana that when I was called as pastor, they had already taken a very open and affirming stance to be supportive of gay and lesbian Christians, to be supportive of people who wish to be ordained. And congregations tend to be kind of insular, you know. They attract people who have similar ideas. But I would think you would be much more liable to hear all the sides.
As a journalist, I dislike the word liable. But
yeah, right.
Different liable, okay. It's pretty clear when you are out, when your face is in the paper regularly and your words are there, and it's a public forum, that there's really no place to hide. I mean, you know, everybody knows my email address, my phone number's in the phone book, and people write regular snail mail as well. So yes, you have to. That's what goes with this territory of being a columnist. But our job as columnists is to make people think, and when the National Society of Newspaper Columnists gathers at its annual conference, we try to remind ourselves of that it's all right to get hate mail, it's all right to taken a strong position on something. That's our job, and whether we make you think by making you laugh or making you cry or giving you an aha moment or however we do it, what we try to do is maybe complicate your thinking a little bit, make it clear to you that maybe you don't have all the answers. Maybe there is another perspective. And that certainly is the case when I write about ordination of gays and lesbians to ministry in any tradition, whether it's my own or others, that people have very strong opinions about that, and they're not hesitant to let me know about it. And you develop a thick skin, and you also try to learn from the ones who aren't just spewing hate at you. But sometimes people who disagree with you will have a good point, and it's important to be open to those points, and I do my best to be that way, not always succeeding, of course.
We're about halfway through our program today on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Bill Tobias. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith will be an interview with State Senator Michael Frerichs about some of the religious issues in the current various campaigns going on in this state and beyond. Evelyn Underwood will be our guest on August 31st, along with Zerniel Bogan. Those two pastors will be talking about their experience as African Americans in some of the issues that face African American pastors these days. On September 7th, Louis Uria will be here talking about the new sanctuary movement, issues of immigration. Ahmad Taha, a Muslim professor, will be our guest on September 14, talking about balancing religion and everyday life for a Muslim. Michelle Holder and others from the campus and some students from the Campus Vegetarian Society will be talking about the ethics of vegetarian eating here on September 21st. Janet Rasmussen, a new pastor, former college president, pastor of the First Mennonite Church of Urbana, will be Don Nolan's guest on September 28th. And I plan to be back on the radio hosting this program on October 5th, talking with Imani Bazell about African-American issues in the current political situation. So those are some of the guests coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. Support for these programs is provided in part by the University YMCA, where for the last 9 years I've been the executive director, and with my retirement this week, Willard Broom, former associate dean of students here at the university, will be stepping in while the search committee continues to look for my permanent replacement as executive director here. The Y is in its 136th year on the University of Illinois campus, the oldest charity in Champaign County, and continues to work developing student leadership by providing opportunities for University of Illinois very bright, brilliant students to be involved in community service and social action, involved in many programs, including Dump and Run, which is one of our big events this coming up this next weekend. We've been collecting for this huge sale of household goods and things for apartments and all kinds of stuff all summer. And we're still collecting the next 2 days, Monday and Tuesday. Monday from noon till 8, and Tuesday from 9 in the morning till 4 at night. And then the sale will be this coming Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, August 23rd, 24th, 25, in the University Stock Pavilion. Huge facility, and this program is supported, of course, by the International Students and Services Unit at the university, We have over 5,000 international students here. 1,500 or so new will be coming in, either have already come in or coming in this week. Many other students will be setting up dorm rooms and apartments, and we're happy to have all these items that have been donated that we can recycle, can keep out of the waste stream, and can make available to students for and others for very inexpensive prices. The sale will start Saturday, August 23rd at 8 in the morning. Go to 5. There's a $2 admission to the Stock Pavilion. On Sunday, it goes from noon until 6, and on Monday from 11 to 2. And that'll be a $3 bag sale. All you can put in a bag for $3. Then from 2:30 to 4, whatever's left is free to the public. So public's invited to all of it, but it's everything will be free Monday after 2:30. So that's our big dump and run extravaganza that the Y has been doing for 7 years now, and it's quite something to see several thousand people come in and find all kinds of things, books and computers and TVs and toys and sporting equipment and books and electronics and bicycles. And we even have a car, I think. So we had a canoe donated this year. So all kinds of things. Do come by the University Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, Steve, let me interrupt to just say congratulations on your retirement.
Well, thank you.
And I want you to know that when my parents were at the University of Illinois, both my parents are U of I grads, the YMCA there was only about half its current age back in the 1930s. But I know my mother at least had some connection to it.
Well, it's been a very active organization here and helpful to many students over the decades. So I've been happy to be a part of it. People have asked if I'm going to continue hosting Keeping the Faith, and I do intend to for at least another year, and we'll see what happens after that. But I've enjoyed both being a pastor in this town and also hosting this radio show since 1999 here on WILL. This is a radio service of the College of Media here in Illinois, WILL AM and FM, 580 on your radio dial, and also 9.9 FM HD2 and HD3. So, Bill, let's get back to talking about your blog and about Faith Matters. And let me encourage listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If you have a question for our religion columnist and blogger, Bill Timaeus, elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. Our technical director, David Heckman, will answer your call and get you on the air if you would like to join the conversation. So do give us a ring, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. So, Bill, how did you get trained theologically? You said you were you had nothing formal, but tell me how you got interested in religious and ethical issues and so forth. Here you are, a humorist columnist.
Yeah. Well, religion can be pretty funny at times.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was growing up, I grew up a member of a small Presbyterian church up in Woodstock, Illinois, and the eternal questions just always engaged me, even as a young junior high and high school student. I did get to the point, as all teenagers pretty much in my generation got to, of looking at the church and saying, man, this place is full of hypocrites. I want out of here. And, in fact, I was out of the church for more than a decade. And finally I realized, oh, you know what? I'm one of them. I need to be back in there. But even in all of that time that I was kind of at least semi-formally divorced from the church, I never quit being fascinated by theological questions. And I read theology when I worked in Rochester, New York in the late 60s. I took a light theology course or two at Colgate-Rochester Divinity School. I'm an odd guy in that much of what I read for pleasure is fairly heavy theology stuff slogging through I don't understand it all, but I try to. And in the end, it seems to me that the questions of eternity and of God and how we are to live as human beings, one to another, relating one to another, is really the primary subject of life. And so I've just stayed with it. I must say that one of the ways that I educated myself was when I came back to church was to get assigned to teach Sunday school. And once you are asked to be a teacher, you better know something. So I got back into understanding what my faith was about. And eventually I also became a member of a committee that oversees seminary students for our presbytery, our regional group of Presbyterian churches here. And when you're trying to guide students into ministry, and in some cases out of ministry, it's, you know, again, you better know something about your own theology. And so that's how I've kind of kept up with it. Now, I must say the last couple of years I've read almost nothing but Holocaust-related books because of the book project I've been
working
on. But even there you run into the questions of what theologians call theodicy. Why is there evil in God's good world? That kind of question.
Sure. We have a caller waiting on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Bill Timaeus. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. You must hear from many interesting people in your communications. What would be some of the more frequent or interesting themes that you discuss with them?
Sometimes I'm asked, an instance, I just had an email over the weekend that said, can you help me understand grace? What is grace about, and how do I make sense of that? I also get questions about political things of, you know, which of the major candidates is really serious about his religious commitment and those sorts of things. So there, just about any question you can imagine coming the way of a religion columnist, I get.
Thank you very much for the call. How did you respond to the question about grace?
It happened to arrive while I was, I spent the last 4 or 5 days kind of lollygagging in Arkansas, taking a little time off with some friends. My wife and I were down there, and I sent her a note back and said, you know, I'm not going to answer this till next week, but I wrote a column that's in my book that has to do with grace, and I invite you to look at that. And then I quickly also found a piece that the Reverend John Buchanan, who's head of Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago, had written about grace in a recent issue of Christian Century, and I sent the person a link about that. But I have not had a chance to go through my own writing and refer her to some things. But what I will tell her is that, like many ideas in theology, grace is something of a mystery. Grace is what I understand to be God's pure, unmerited favor. That it's what we don't deserve but get anyway because God loves us. And how that happens, why it happens, and the difference between common grace, which is the idea that everybody in the world gets air to breathe, gets a beautiful scenery to look at, and the idea of more specific grace is one that theologians wrestle with. So I'll play around with those ideas when I finally respond to her.
It's, of course, perfectly fair for you as a columnist and a blogger to respond from your own Christian perspective, but how do you make sure you're fair when you know, not too prejudiced when you deal with folks from other faiths?
One way is that I have tried for a very long time to understand what other faiths teach. I spent a couple of years of my boyhood living in India, where I lived next to a Muslim village and went to school with Hindus and Sikhs and Jains and others, as well as Christians, and was exposed to many other faiths. And so I have taken the time to study some of their responses to some of these questions, and I frankly draw on some of their insights, because they certainly have insights. Particularly since 9/11, I have spent a lot of time studying and reading and writing about Islam, as you know, Steve, for both personal and professional reasons. I've tried professionally to help readers understand the faith of Islam and to understand that the hijackers of those airplanes that day twisted that religion and used it as for ideological purposes. And then personally, I had to understand why anyone would want to kill my nephew, who was a passenger on the first plane to hit the World Trade Center. And so I've written a lot about Islam, and even taken a trip to the Middle East and to Saudi Arabia and Egypt, Uzbekistan, and attended a number of conferences in this country about Muslims in America. So I do try in my columns and elsewhere to not simply be writing what anybody would think of as Presbyterian sermons, but rather drawing on the broader traditions and bringing to the fore some of the ideas that one might find in Buddhism, for instance, about suffering, or that one might find in Judaism about being in a covenant relationship with God. And I'm imperfect at that task, but it's one that I try to take seriously.
There are a lot of commonalities between some of the world's great religions, but as you've mentioned in some of your writings, including in your book, A Gift of Meaning, there have been many people who have perhaps used religion as a way to get what they want, either in terms of money or sex or power or all three. There have been others who have sort of formed their own religions, which maybe don't come up to the same ethical standards that some of the world's greatest religions do. How do you watch out for the danger in religion?
Well, I think there are some clues as to what is a healthy religion and what isn't. I think, for instance, if you are quoting from your own holy scriptures, whether it's the Bible or the Hebrew scriptures or the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita, and you're using that primarily to say no to people, to put people down, to raise you up above others, that's a pretty good indication that you're not using scripture in a healthy way. When your religion doesn't help you live a way in which you are a whole person, but rather helps you to enables you to try to dominate others and to be the great king of the family and so on. It is possible to misuse religion in a way that allows you to be the one with power and to use that power oppressively. I just think that we need to be careful not to do that, and also to remember that we have a limited capacity to understand the divine. That we must bow before mystery ultimately. Now, I had an associate pastor who said that he had a seminary teacher who said, now don't start appealing to mystery when it's only the seventh inning. And I like that, but
yeah.
But nonetheless, in the end, I think if we look at something like the Rule of Benedict from the Catholic tradition and recognize that the promotion of the idea of humility is one that would really serve us well, as opposed to the idea that we know everything there is to know about salvation, I think that helps to be in touch with those sorts of values, but nobody gets it all right.
In your book, A Gift of Meaning, a collection of some of your columns, you have several themes, the way you write draws people into those themes. Do you ever feel the danger yourself of being too much of an authority? Here are people reading your newspaper, your words in the paper, in books, in a blog online. Are there temptations for the columnist, for the blogger?
Oh, yeah, all the time. It's something you have to worry about, and I think it's something that I try, at least now and then, to say, I don't have all the answers, but this is what I do know, and you need to be getting your information from more than one source. If you are just reading one newspaper, if you're just listening to just Rush Limbaugh, or if you're just watching Jon Stewart, you're really limited in what you understand about life. And so I try to tell people, in some ways in the column, in some ways in the blog, and certainly when I go out and give public talks, which I do fairly frequently, that you need someone beyond me to help you form opinions and to analyze the world. But yeah, there's always the danger of getting seduced by your own authority and thinking that you know absolutely everything. And when people come up and tell you, you know, that was a piece that changed my life, well, you think to yourself, wow, what a powerful guy I am. And you have to remember, no, that's really not what it's about.
I noticed when I did a web search this afternoon just to see if there were any breaking things with your name in it, that you now are on YouTube for a minute and 17 seconds, but I think most of it is a long question someone asked at one of your speaking engagements, and I'm not sure if you even got to answer.
It was a question. It was a group called the Community of Reason, is basically agnostics and atheists, and this one particular fellow had been kind of on my case about why in the world you're a man of faith and why don't you join the rest of us atheists because we know everything. And so he was asking this, of why don't you just throw off that silliness? And yeah, I knew he was taping it. I didn't know it was going to end up on YouTube. But don't we all ultimately end up on YouTube?
Apparently, yes. We're talking with Bill Timaeus, and he's the author of a book, a collection of his columns, A Gift of Meaning. He and a rabbi have worked together on a book that will be coming out sometime, and I think you said probably next year.
Yep.
They Were Just People.
By the way, that will be, we hope in the next month or so that we will have a website about the book up running called theywerejustpeople.com. So
okay.
If you want to make note of that, any listeners, take a look at it. That site should be up in the next several weeks.
Bill Timaeus is a weekly columnist for the Kansas City Star, as well as a daily blogger, six blogs a week. Can be found at kansascity.com with a link to his blog or by going directly to Bill Timaeus, T-A-M-M-E-U-S, .typepad.com. Bill, we're down to our last couple minutes. Any last thing you'd like to share about your life as a blogger on Faith Matters?
Well, the thing that has come kind of distressed me a little bit about this is that I had had an open comment section for a long time, and eventually I had to close that and make it a moderated thing. So I look at all the comments that are left because people were beginning to spam me and were beginning to use that space as a way of adding to the dissonant discourse in our society, and I wasn't going to be a party to that.
So there are still comments, but there are ones that you've approved.
Yeah, and I approved nearly all of them. I don't. You know, I just knock out. I won't allow profanity and that sort of thing. But you can certainly criticize me or say pretty much whatever you want. But I was sorry that I had to do that. I really felt that I didn't want to be any kind of censor, and I'm really not. But it showed me that the human capacity to degenerate into that sort of stuff is just very deeply ingrained in us, I'm afraid.
Well, we do, even on WILL, on this NPR regional station, have a button we can push when a caller gets abusive or crazy. Fortunately, we don't have to do that much on Keeping the Faith, so I do want to thank our callers for their usually very good questions and politeness to our guests, and we do have a variety of guests, as listeners know, here on Keeping the Faith. We are out of time today with our guest, Bill Tobias. I want to thank Bill for being on the program, and I look forward to his book that's coming out next year, University of Missouri Press, They Were Just People. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, I remind listeners, State Senator Mike Frerix will be talking about spiritual and ethical issues in the news today. On August 31st, we have two pastors who are the president and vice president of the Ministerial Alliance, Reverend Evelyn Underwood and Reverend Zerniel Bogan, who will be our guests. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for Keeping the Faith, director of the University YMCA for the next 3 days. Remind people of the collections Monday and Tuesday for Dump and Run, and the sale next Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Steve.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Science writer Fred Pierce thinks we're running out of water. He's traveled the world to investigate the current state of crucial water sources. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Pierce talks about the defining crisis of the 21st century. Also, we'll explore the social history of swimming pools in America. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7. Have a question about digital radio or digital TV? Come to the WILL Digital Information Fair and Open House Sunday, August 24th from 2 to 4:30 at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana. Get your questions answered, tour Campbell Hall, meet our on-air hosts, and enter to win a digital TV or digital radio. We hope to see you Sunday, August 24th at Campbell Hall.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Billy Baruz, Champagne, Cannon Farms, Camargo, K.C. Summers, Mattoon, The Andersons, Champaign, and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3, Urbana.